From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This will be the first in a series of four extras where we're going to bring you highlights from a series of talks that were given towards the end of last year called Codebreakers Legacy. This first one is the highlights of the talk given by Professor Barry Cooper of Leeds University and chair of the Alan Turing Committee. After Barry's talk, there's an interview with Barry and Professor Jack Copeland. We've had it in one of the earlier podcast episodes, but here it's within context. If you'd like to attend a talk like this at Bletchley Park, then please just go to the website bletchleypark.org.uk and go to the What's On section. So, as you would expect, Barry's talk is on Alan Turing.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Bletchley Park. I'm Bob Horner, and it is my great privilege to introduce four wonderful speakers today on a particularly important day, of course, because it's the start, really, of the weekend's remembrance commemorations. And of course, it reminds us that the people that we're going to be talking about today, they didn't come here to do the things that ultimately came from what they did. They came here to help win the war. So it's my great privilege to welcome Professor Barry Cooper, who is going to talk about Can Machines Decode?
Thank you very much. Some of the technical problems we were dealing with early on, it kind of reminded me that one thing that Bletchley Park embodies is the kind of alliance between the abstract and the physical. And different communities see computation in different ways. I guess the engineering end of the spectrum, that they see things as very ad hoc and dealing with difficult physical problems like we had earlier. And from the mathematical end, it's just a Turing machine. And I guess there's been some kind of friction between these different communities over the years. And I'm going to talk about this kind of interface between abstraction and the physical, and the way it's embodied in Bletchley Park, in Turing's work and person, and I guess in the human brain as well. And of course, that goes back to Descartes and the kind of what's the relationship between mentality and the physical brain. So the title of the talk is essentially taken from this famous paper of Turing's from 1950. And he famously asked, can machines think? And this kind of question has been echoed throughout the years. What I want to try and convince you is that actually the key to this question is the decoding. It's decoding of information, drawing information out of sometimes very complicated information. And what I'm going to talk about a little bit is about this kind of abstract idea of the difference between different levels of information. That nowadays, the big buzzword is big data, and people always talk about big data, and it kind of crops up in all sorts of different contexts. Well, decoding is about taking big data and drawing some kind of basic meaning out of it that we can make use of, often in computational ways. There's all sorts of contributions that Alan Turing made. One of the other themes of this talk will be that Bletchley Park actually played a huge part in Turing's thinking. Turing and Bletchley Park is kind of a marriage made in heaven, as it were. Turing has benefited Bletchley Park in lots of ways through the kind of prominence he's had in the media and so on, belated prominence. And of course, Bletchley Park meant a lot to Turing, and it meant a lot to his thinking. People look at it and they say, well, it rather distracted him from his mathematics, but actually it played into the way he thought scientifically about things. And many of the kind of key contributions he made later on would never have been made if he hadn't been involved in the kind of practical work of Bletchley Park. Born in London, of course, in 1912. He was a child of the empire, as it were. His parents were working in India most of the time, and his mother and father came back to visit. Him and his brother John were fostered. They went to primary school together. They ended up at different public schools. John, who didn't have quite such a kind of close relationship with Alan, claims to have saved him from Marlborough, and he went to Sherborne instead. Here is a rather thoughtful young lad in 1927 when he first arrived at Sherborne. And you see the kind of intense kind of focus, that the inner kind of mental world, as it seemed to be developing over the years. He had things of his own personally that he wanted to work out. There's an important kind of an interplay between the personal and the success in science as it's played out later on. What happened with Turing, of course, was that he had a long, full scientific career in a short space of time. And a lot of that was lost to us for many years. And it's only in recent years that knowledge of all sorts of things is coming back to us. It ended up prematurely in 1954. Turing made some of his most key contributions, which in a sense reflect what he learnt from the Bletchley Park experience in Manchester. Of course, Manchester was, in a sense, a rather kind of complex experience for Turing. Some of his most interesting work he produced there. He died there and he was persecuted there. But Manchester since that time has been rather good to Turing and has honoured him in all sorts of ways. My favourite statue is at Bletchley Park. It's the slate statue. Things played out in a rather raw terms at the end. You can get a sense of the kind of inappropriateness and rawness of the ending of this very vital and mentally alive man, that this should have been the ending of his life. He was close to Olympic standard marathon runner. There's an Alan Garner interview, and he said to Alan Garner that the reason why he ran was in order to think. Here you've got, again, this kind of alliance between the physical and the mental, that actually the physical conditions have to be right for the abstractions to play out. 2012 was a centenary. In some ways, it was a kind of belated acknowledgement of Turing's history and work and personal history. So many events happened around that time and are still playing out now, that there are things planned for this year and next year. And, of course, 2014, well, people say, well, isn't Turing a household name now? Isn't it or a bit overdone, you know, this all this publicity for Turing? No, it's not. If you go out into the real world, sometimes you'll mention Turing and they'll say, who is Turing? I would say that although it's within the cognoscenti, as it were, Turing is kind of extremely well known. The kind of broad knowledge that one would hope for hasn't quite arrived yet. 2014, we'll see a little bit more about Turing and his work reach the broader masses, if you like. The Imitation Game that's just being shot with Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley. A lot of these things are controversial, of course, because people are scared that actually this is not going to be true to the history, that the commercial pressures are going to sabotage, if you like, a true account of what happened. Well, there's going to be some bending towards, the filmmakers surviving in the real world. But all the things we've seen so far have been quite promising, and Keira Knightley, she does represent a real person, and the relationship did exist and was a close one over a number of years. I'm a mathematician, and I'm kind of interested in the kind of abstract ideas around computation and computability and decoding and information. But at the same time, through my involvement with Bletchley Park and people who have been involved in the development of computers and bioinformatics and other such things which involve in a material way with the world, I've become interested in, if you like, this building of computational artifacts, the building of the brain, the building of computers, the building of the world that we live in as a kind of material host for computation. And this is what Turing was very much gripped by right from childhood. He was personally ideally suited to this kind of a scientific adventure, if you like. Here's Max Newman, who was Turing's protector and mentor throughout most of his life. He was at Cambridge and Manchester and, of course, Bletchley Park. And here he is saying that actually, despite Turing's work in pure mathematics, he was actually at heart a pure mathematician. He built everything up from the basics. He was interested in physics. He was interested in the way the world computed at a very basic level. His only PhD student, Robin Gandy, started off as an applied mathematician and only got interested in the logic through Turing. I stayed with Robin before he died, and I asked him about Alan Turing and why he'd commit suicide. And he said a week before he saw Turing, he was perfectly cheerful and seemed nothing wrong. Robin was in no doubt that it was suicide, but he said that things that happen in the real world, they're not easily computable. Some things happen for no reason, one might say. Well, paradoxically, of course, Turing is best known for de-embodying the computer. This is what the computer scientists and mathematicians think of when they think about computing machines. They think about a Turing machine. And, of course, it was revolutionary in the sense that before this period in time, computing machines were like, they were more calculating machines. Every time you wanted a particular job done, you built a new machine. You know, you changed the physical kind of, the physical embodiment of the computation. Turing's model, in a sense, does away with that. It says that actually the cleverness of the embodied computation can actually be captured in abstract programming. So the hardware, it's so trivial that for mathematicians, it just exists in your head. And the model of the Turing machine, despite its simplicity of hardware, the programming enables you to compute anything that you could conceivably compute via instructions. But I should say here that, this Turing being a kind of a man embedded in the physicality and the basics of things, he did have a specific model in his head when he invented the Turing machine. He had the idea of a computer which would be normally a person following instructions at that time, and generally a woman computer. And he had this idea of that the person who was carrying out the computation, not applying human intelligence, but just following instructions, and a nod in the direction of the real reality of the human brain was that the use of a thing called an internal state to structure the computation, and that's kind of based on the state of mind, if you like. So if you're in a particular state of mind, then you compute in a different way, and that was the idea behind this. Now, there's a contradiction here, of course, as anybody who's tried to build a computer knows, is that actually it's not a Turing machine. There is an awful lot of embodiment involved in building a real computer. And David Levitt has this idea of Turing identifying with the machine. And I think that's a nice kind of insight into the way Turing had a kind of visceral involvement with the machines that he was talking about. In the popular culture, there's all sorts of kind of plays on this mismatch between the abstraction and the embodiment of computation. Everybody knows about the Turing machine. Well, I say everybody in my community knows about the Turing machine. But many people in my community even don't understand what's important about a universal Turing machine. The 1936 paper in which Turing describes the universal Turing machine, it uses the fact that if you characterise your programs in a particular language, in a particular form, then you can actually list all the possible programs. And if you can list them, then you can code them up as numbers. And this enables you to actually list, if you accept the Turing model of what computation is, then it actually gives you a list of all the kind of possible programs, all the possible mathematical functions that you can compute using a computer program. And that's rather clever, isn't it? But it's a trick, and it kind of hides something. What it hides is the fact that actually machines are not codable in general. My laptop, it's there, it's following programs, but it actually is a physical entity, and it's going to do things at some point. It could crash any moment. There's all sorts of things my computer could do that it's not programmed to do, and that is not coded in. So there's a kind of piece of sleight of hand here which is tremendously important for the history of the computer, because it did away with punch tapes and other ways of physically inputting programs into machines. It enables you to code up programs as numbers, and that means they're data the same as any other data. And you can feed them in, and you can modify your program using your computer. You can receive over the internet updates of your software using the fact that your programs are actually all coded up and no longer physical entities. A very dominant paradigm, the paradigm of the universal Turing machine. Turing could be excused for being rather optimistic in 1944 at Hanslope Park, where he went after Bletchley Park. He's quoted as saying, "I'm building a brain," and he was building a computing machine. This has been run with by philosophers, particularly Hilary Putnam, and the idea is that you can actually take this as a model for all sorts of computational contexts. In particular, you can take this model into neuroscience and philosophy of the mind, and you can think of what the brain is doing as being some kind of computation which can be transferred to different physical hosts. And in particular, maybe you can build a machine that does what the human brain does. It's a very ambitious kind of picture, and it kind of takes the Turing model to its furthest application. And then there's people like David Deutsch, a key figure in the development of the early model of quantum computation. He successfully reduces the model of quantum computation to the Turing model. And here he is saying, well, perhaps we can do the same for consciousness. Perhaps, you know, we'll have conscious machines pretty soon and, well, in the course of time. His 1936 paper, the whole point of the paper was not inventing the computer. It was showing that actually computers can't do everything. Even though we hadn't got computers, he had a theorem which said that computers won't be able to do everything. There are unsolvable problems, and this plays out with so-called Church's theorem, or Turing had it as well. There's no computer program which will tell you whether a sentence in natural language is logically valid or not. Your intuition is that if somebody tells you something, you'll be able to identify whether it's a logically correct statement. Things get complicated. There's no program for that. Now, of course, in the post-war period, Turing played a role in the development of real computers, if you like, although it was kind of frustrating, his involvement, and he didn't stick with it. His ACE report came out the same time as von Neumann's, didn't get the same attention and didn't have the same influence. But there was a computer developed using Turing's ideas, scaled down, which I don't think played out well with Turing. He went off to Manchester before this happened. But the computer that was developed was the fastest in the world for a short period. The universal Turing machine and its relation to the history of the computer, another controversial area. To what extent was ad hoc investigation at the root of the development of the computer? To what extent was Turing's universal machine? Well, John von Neumann muddies the waters. He understood what Turing was doing. It's not clear at what point he kind of realised exactly what he was getting from Turing's work, but he played a big part in the development of the computer in the United States. He had a famous report in the 1940s, but he did later in life acknowledge the debt that the history of the computer owed to, at least the understanding of the history of the computer owed to Turing's universal machine. What was so important about Bletchley Park was that it was grappling with information at different levels. This had a physical dimension, which was the development of early programmable machines, in a sense, that could multitask in some particular context. Machines which helped with grappling with the big data. If you look at the noisy kind of meaningless stuff that was coming through, that is big data, and that's what these people were handling. The real business of Bletchley Park was dealing with the big data of decoding. So sometimes you get information and it takes a lot of intelligence to bring out the meaning. One of the things which is fundamental to dealing with big data is sampling. And this is something that's played into the work at Bletchley Park and had an influence afterwards. People like Jack Good, assistant to Turing, and other people developed statistical methods for drawing out meaning from data which was large and confusing. In particular, they used statistical methods of Thomas Bayes from the 18th century. And Banbarismus, of course, was one of the great breakthroughs in the Battle of the Atlantic. Bletchley Park and Turing's engagement with big data in different guises is a legacy, and it's something which is still playing out and still gives us lots of puzzles and issues that are not yet sorted. And this idea of higher type information is probably key to this, and incomputability and embodiment. Out in the real world, of course, the Turing test is an endless source of jokes and amusement. And it's the one thing that I would say probably has received some kind of mass acknowledgement, even from people who've never heard of Turing. They talk about the Turing test. I guess in the scientific world, there's not so much regard given to the Turing test, although people can't get rid of it. The interesting thing about it, of course, is that it kind of recognises the primacy of the human brain as a kind of benchmark for intelligence. And he's still hankering after the brain being a Turing machine, but what he's ending up with is the fact that interaction with human beings is still necessary and advisable. And, of course, this is what we had at Bletchley Park. We had the new machines developed. We had a tremendous amount of human creativity thrown together with this. And this was the model which produced the goods at that time.
After the explosion of interest in Alan Turing's life and work during his centenary year last year, you might have expected this year to be a bit quieter. Well, it definitely hasn't been. I've got two Turing experts with me now.
Professor Welching hippies. Two 60s children.
Or 50s, some of us.
Get away with you.
I've got Jack Copeland and Barry Cooper with me here. What do you think is going to happen in the next year? A pardon? A new film? I mean, do you think Turing's finally becoming a household name?
Yeah, I'd say Turing's becoming a household name. It's taken a long time, but it's happening.
Well, it would be great if it did happen. I must admit that there's lots of indications that Turing's not as well known still as he should be. A friend of mine, her daughter, was in a class where the kids were asked about Alan Turing, and she was the only person in the whole class. This was secondary school, the only person in the whole class who'd heard of Alan Turing. So it's still an uphill journey, I think. But with the movie and the possibility of a pardon next year, I think there'll be a lot of media interest in Turing.
But I mean, even 5 years ago, maybe, I don't think, would you have even had one person in that class who would have known who Turing was? I think we have come a long way, really, haven't we?
Yeah, one of the really nice things over the last couple of years is that school kids write to me and say, I'm doing my project on Turing. You know, can I email a few questions to you, or can we talk on Skype? And I guess this has happened, well, more than half a dozen times now. So Turing is getting out into the schools, certainly not as much as he should. There's a long way to go yet. But it started. We're just seeing the beginnings of it now, and it will grow and grow.
I mean, the film definitely is going to make a big difference, isn't it? I mean, what do you think about the casting?
Well, I thought that people were being a little unfair to the filmmakers in the early days, and I think now people are beginning to realise that the filmmakers, their heart's in the right place anyway, even if they are under commercial pressure. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch is a great choice. He's the right sort of person. He's a great actor, and he's fairly well known around the world. And Keira Knightley, I don't share the criticisms that that people have made, although I haven't seen the way the plot works out. So it'll be interesting. Fingers crossed it'll all be true to the history.
Yeah, I think Cumberbatch is, you know, nearly perfect for the role. And there were so many scare stories about other American actors who are going to be taking the role, you know, over the last few years. And I can remember feeling physically relieved when I heard that Cumberbatch was taking it on. I think it'll be a great thing for Turing. I'm looking forward to it.
I would just say, I think it's going to be nice for the kind of geekish kids, you know, the kind of get bullied in school and so on, and there'll be some appreciation of the individuality and the kind of contribution and the kind of pure heroism of intellectual adventurers in the world nowadays.
Because we've spoken before that Turing, he's such a great figurehead for so many different types of people, isn't he? Yeah. In the gay community, the Asperger's community, exactly. The geeky community. Exactly. And, you know, having someone that they can relate to, oh, it's Sherlock Holmes from the TV, is actually this guy, in a way, is another in, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, you use the word Asperger's, and I think that's a kind of community that needs a little positive attention. I think kids at school can often have a terrible time, you know, if they're a little bit geekish. Things get better as you get older, you know. You go to university, you get in a field with people, similar kind of approach to life, and things get a lot better. And I think kids should realise that that can happen. Of course, Turing's not a great example, you know, in the sense that he was bullied in later life for being gay, and that we still have to get over in some way.
So do we move on to another codebreaker next, or do we carry on fighting for Alan's name and making him more famous, and making him that household name he should be?
I personally will be doing both. It's not an either-or. I think there's a lot more to be written and said about Turing. But, of course, there are all these other fascinating figures, like Bill Tutt and like Tommy Flowers, and I shall continue working on these characters as well.
Yeah, I'd like to see more attention to all sorts of scientists. I think science isn't properly valued in the UK as it should be, and I think other countries probably, you know, that don't make such a great contribution to science, scientists are better valued.
Yes, and the sort of, you know, like theoretical science has, you know, kind of more kudos than the practical end of it. It's sort of, there's this, you know, kind of hierarchy. There's the arts, and then there's, you know, like physics and the theoretical stuff, and then there's engineering. And I think one of the really good things about Bletchley Park and the whole code-breaking story is that it brings out the importance of engineering and the fact that engineers make breakthroughs too. It isn't just theoretical physicists.
Yeah, I mean, Colossus couldn't have existed without Tommy Flowers, could it?
That's right. It was his idea. He built it.
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the great kind of outcomes of the Turing year is that we're getting all these fantastic books about history, about the science, about the code breaking, about Bletchley Park and so on. And I think Jack's book is great. It's got all sorts of good stuff in it. And I think my book, which was a labour of love that almost killed me off, is something everybody should have on their bookshelves, but if they can afford it.
Yeah, I think it's great. There's this whole wave, this torrent of new work on Turing coming out. And, you know, many, many books came out last year on Turing, all of them excellent. I'm proud to be part of it. And Barry's book is just tremendous. You know, the definitive collection on Turing.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.